Some of you may be very familiar with that psalm, and it has a refrain that goes throughout it. It has a statement and then a refrain, a statement and then a refrain through the whole thing, which is 26 verses. If you ever read these, you're reading them out loud to your children, you know, after about the 18th verse, you get the same refrain going on, but it does this through the whole thing. And the refrain that it does is, "For his steadfast love endures forever." And so starting with verse 1, we'll read the first 9 verses. And then down in 23, it says, "Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever. Give thanks to the God of gods, for his steadfast love endures forever. Give thanks to the Lord of lords, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who alone does great wonders, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who by understanding made the heavens, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who spread out the earth above the waters, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who made the great lights, for his steadfast love endures forever. The sun to rule over the day, for his steadfast love endures forever. The moon and stars to rule over the night, for his steadfast love endures forever." And then down in verse 23, "It is he who remembered us in our low estate, for his steadfast love endures forever, and rescued us from our foes, for his steadfast love endures forever. He who gives food to all flesh, for his steadfast love endures forever. Give thanks to the God of heaven, for his steadfast love endures forever." Well, this morning we want to look at one attribute or one characteristic of the nature of God. And as I was thinking about this, you say, well, you know, I want us to contemplate God. And if I were sitting out there, I'd say, how can we do that in one Sunday school lesson? Well, I'm only going to introduce you to a topic. And it'll be for you to pursue that topic. To think about God is something that you could never fully exhaust if you spent your whole lifetime doing it. But I want us to look at one attribute of it, and the reason we're going to do this morning in Sunday school lesson is we have been over the, I guess, some months ago, looked at John with the I am story, you know, the I ams that he had. I am the bread of heaven, I am the light, I am the shepherd, and Jesus was talking to the people there, and he was explaining to them who he was and who God was, and explaining to them and giving them the message. And then we looked at, after that, looked at some in Ephesians 1, 2, and 3 about what God has done for the redeemed. If you remember about all spiritual blessings that he's given us in heavenly places and the great covenant that he's established with us and how he blesses us and prepared a place for us. He took us as his own family and adopted us. And then we looked at Ruth and a kinsman redeemer, and how that God, the providence of God in protecting and providing for those people and taking someone who was a foreigner and bringing her into his family, and through that situation and this provision he had set up with the kinsman redeemer for Ruth to go from being somebody who was just gathering wheat in a field to being married to Boaz and being in the line of David. And if you look at all of those stories and think about them, behind all those stories is God. God the Father as we know him. And as he is wanting to communicate to the redeemed, as he is wanting to care for them, as he establishes his covenant. And sometimes, I don't know about you, but I get caught up in reading a passage or studying a book. And I'm trying to master a topic, just like you do in math or science or something. And I forget all about the person who's behind it, who is communicating this to us, and who loves us. And so what I want us to do this morning is to think just a minute, for a little while rather, about the nature of God and an attribute of God. And as I read in that Psalm 136... it has to do with the steadfast love of God. And this may be something that that in your Bible may be translated differently as you look at it. Sometimes it's translated as mercies. Sometimes it's translated as loving kindness. But in the version I'm looking at, it's translated as steadfast love. And if I were to ask you about the nature of God, you could probably give me a list of things. Some of you have studied systematic theology. You've talked about the different attributes of God, and you have certain ones that are His alone, omniscience and omnipresence and omnipotence, all the things that He can do in His power and knowledge. And you think about some of the other ones that are ones that He desires for His people to be, which are kindness and mercy and goodness, holiness, all of the things He has for us. And as I mentioned, sometimes we look at these and we think of it in sort of a abstract version, that we have a list of things and we know what those are, and this is what God is all about. But in looking at this particular aspect of God, I wanted to take it a little bit differently and look at somebody who knew Him in the Old Testament. I don't know about you, but it helps me lots of times if I can, somebody who knows a person, if you want to go find out about a person, what do? You go and ask somebody who knows them, and you go and find out something about them. And so I wanted to go and to ask somebody who lived in the Old Testament about this and to find out how they felt about God. And so the character that we want to read about who knew God, I want to give you sort of a bio. Have you ever been to these presentations where they have you come and speak and they tell all the things about this person? I've been at one of those, this person has been here, been there, and done all this stuff. And I'm thinking, I don't know who they're talking about. And then you get up there, and you're this person. Well, I want to tell you who we're going to ask about. And this is the person we're going to find out what God is like in this steadfast love business that's all through Psalm 136. Okay? And let me give you the little bio on this person. First of all, he was an unemployed musician. And maybe you can figure out who this is. His boss actually tried to kill him. Now, I don't know if you've had that situation happen to you. But as far as finances and his status, he was a homeless person who traveled all over the countryside, living in caves, doing what he could, picking up odd jobs here and there, watching people's sheep sometimes, not always getting paid for it. Okay. As far as his friends, they were a bunch of ruffians, folks who were outcasts, the people who lived by their wits and by their might. Actually, his friends weren't too loyal, because when their stuff was stolen, they all wanted to mutiny and probably kill him. As far as his family, when they had this big feast, they left him out watching the sheep. But his brothers all thought he was sort of a hothead. There was a situation where somebody was challenging them, and he stood up and said, "Why are you backing down from this guy?" And he said, "What are you, a shepherd? What are you telling us to do? You're just a boy." So his family didn't think much of him. But I want to go and, as you look at it, talk to this person and find out what he thinks about God. And you probably figured out who that is. Who's the character we're talking about? David. Exactly right. Now, with that bio, he would not get very many speaking engagements. All right? But there's something about his life that is amazing, because he understands this concept of the love, steadfast love of God. And so we want to look at that with David. Now, as we contemplate this, when you read that in the Bible just a minute, and we're getting ready to get started looking at Psalm 86, but when you read that, love is something that's very common to us, and we are very familiar with it. We sing about it. We talk about it. We love everything from ice cream to cars. All sorts of things we do about love. And it's constantly, people are all, if you took probably half the song industry, would be gone if you took all the love songs out of it. All the things about love, it would be gone. One of the things that my daughters played for me was a funny little thing that was about a country song, about what happens when you play a country song backwards. You've probably heard that. And it says, you get your truck back you get your hair back, you get your wife or girlfriend back, you get all these things back, because they're all enamored and singing about what they lost, the lost love and all of these sorts of things that they have. But when David talks about love, he is not talking about love and steadfast love like we're talking about. Whereas we usually think of love in a way in which it is something that makes me feel good or something that benefits me lots of times. When I love you, it's because I like what you do, or it makes me feel good, or there's some emotional attachment to it. And what David is talking about is going to go beyond that. So let's turn in Psalm 86, just a minute. Psalm 86 is a psalm that we're actually going to look at, that David talks about steadfast love in his situation. And as you're turning there, Psalm 86 is going to have a series of requests in it and statements that David makes. But he's also going to have, in verses 5, 13, and 15, he's going to remember about God and call upon him because of his steadfast love. And we're going to talk about what that steadfast love means. So let's read Psalm 86 and look at what David is saying here. Psalm 86, verse 1. It says, "Incline your ear, O Lord, and answer me, for I am poor and needy. Preserve my life, for I am godly. Save your servant who trusts in you. You are my God. Be gracious to me, O Lord, for to you do I cry all the day. Gladden the soul of your servant, for to you, O Lord, do I lift up my soul. For you, O Lord, are good and forgiving, abounding in steadfast love, to all who call upon you. Give ear, O Lord, to my prayer. Listen to my plea for grace. In the day of my trouble, I call upon you, for you answer me. There is none like you among the gods, O Lord, nor are there any works like yours. All the nations you have made shall come and worship before you, O Lord, and shall glorify your name. For you are great and do wondrous things. You alone are God. Teach me your way, O Lord, that I may walk in your truth. Unite my heart to fear your name. I give thanks to you, O Lord my God, with my whole heart, and I will glorify your name forever. For great is your steadfast love toward me. You have delivered my soul from the depths of Sheol. O God, insolent men have risen up against me. A band of ruthless men seek my life, and they do not set you before them. But you, O Lord, are a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. Turn to me and be gracious to me. Give your strength to your servant and save the son of your maidservant. Show me a sign of your favor that those who hate me may see and be put to shame. Because you, Lord, have helped me and comforted me." In this particular psalm that we look at, David has a series of things that he requests, and we're going to look at some of the details in just a minute, is that he goes through, and in the first four verses, he states things about he requests of God for him to hear him because of these things. And if you look at, I want to look at just a couple of verses to start with. In verse 1, you get the situation that David is in. He says, "Incline your ear, O Lord, and answer me, for I am poor and needy." And then he goes through a series of things. And if you look down at verse 14, what is the main issue that he's trying to deal with? What's the thing that is besetting him? Is that there's a group of insolent men who have risen up against me. A band of ruthless men seek my life, and they do not set you before them. And so in David's need, he calls out to God, and in verses 5 and 13 and 15, he calls upon God, he remembers God, and he invokes this steadfast love that God has as a reason for God to act. And he remembers this, and he calls upon him, and he describes God with his steadfast love. Now, in beginning to look at that, what is that verse and what is that phrase? And yours might be loving kindness or tender mercies or something like that. But when David uses that word, he's not just using a word that he invented or something that he started with. But that particular word is tied to the covenant that God has established with his people. And a couple of places I want to point out is that in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 12 and 13, this is what it says about this. It says, "And because you listen to these rules and keep and do them, the Lord your God will keep with you the covenant and the steadfast love that he swore to your fathers." He binds these two things together, the covenant and steadfast love that he swore to their fathers. And then also in 2 Samuel 7:15, we find when David wanted to build a house for the Lord, and Nathan came and told him, no, that Solomon, your son, was going to do that. And he tells David that he would be establishing a covenant, an everlasting kingdom with Solomon. And in that, he says that he would not remove his love from Solomon, but says, "But my steadfast love will not depart from him as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you." In one other place, in Isaiah 55, it talks about where God is calling the people, and he says in that particular thing, "I will make an everlasting covenant with you, the steadfast love of David." So the people here understood when David uses this, he's using an expression which has to do with the love, the covenant that God has established with his people, and the steadfast love that he has for his people that will endure. One of the commentators described it this way. He says, "When used of God, this particular word denotes, in general, the divine love condescending to his creatures, more especially to sinners, and unmerited kindness. It is frequently associated with forgiveness and is practically equivalent to mercy and mercifulness in Exodus 20, showing loving kindness unto thousands of them that love me in Exodus 34. Slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, keeping loving kindness for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin in Numbers 14. So when David is talking about his particular situation, his particular need, he's calling upon God and remembering God's promise of loving kindness to them that's established in the covenants that he's made with them. One of the things, if you take this in fast forward that we talked about in Ephesians chapter 1, you say, well, where is this kind of found in the New Testament? How do we see it in there? You remember back when we studied in Ephesians 1 that God said that he's given us all spiritual blessings in heavenly places, that in love he predestined us to the adoption, that in love that God had established that he would adopt us into his family. And so if you look at it, and we think sometimes of God in his covenant and God with his creature as sort of a foreign ruler who has a domain. But behind this is not just some rules or not just some contract or something that God has established, but there is a love that God has established for his redeemed. And he binds that together with the covenant language that he's using, and that is what David is calling upon in his time of need. In Psalm 103, David describes this. He describes his steadfast love as high as heavens above the earth, so great is his steadfast love towards those who fear him. And in verse 17, he says, "The steadfast love of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting to those who fear him." David's understanding of this was that it is without bounds, and it is without end. Now that is a great comfort to us as creatures, is it not? That God's love transcends time and transcends boundaries. Because if you think about it, if it wasn't like that, it would be a very perilous situation that we would be in. Because God doesn't put his love upon us because something we have done, neither does he continue his love just because we do a good enough job, or we earn enough, or we get enough credits from him, or anything like that. If you look at the life of David, certainly that wasn't the case with him. But David had an understanding of the steadfast love of God, and he describes it as without bound and without end. Now let's look at Psalm 86 just a minute in some detail, because what we want to do is to understand what David is doing here in 86, but also one of the questions that's coming up is, why did David have such an appreciation for this? What was there about his life? And that's where the whole thing started, is somebody who knows God, knows something about God, and why is that in their life? Because maybe we could learn a few things in our life because we face the same things. So in Psalm 86, we're going to briefly go through the different sections that we have here and look at what David is doing. And then if you look at verses 1, 2, 3, and 4 in Psalm 86, each of these have sort of a request and then a statement. And the first one is, incline your ear, O Lord, and answer me. And then he says, for I am needy, poor and needy. And then he says in 2, preserve my life, for I am godly. Or preserve my life, for I am godly. Save your servant who trusts in you. You are my God. Verse 3, be gracious. And then he says, I cry all the day. Verse 4, gladden the soul of your servant. I lift up my soul. He goes through these and he's asking God, because of his situation, to incline his ear, to preserve him, be gracious and gladden. And then it's as if he has and remembers who God is and states it in verse 5. This is a person he's calling out to, and he reminds God who he is. He says, for you, O Lord, are good and forgiving, abounding in steadfast love to all who call upon you. And then he does the same thing in verse 6, where he says, he makes a request, give ear, O Lord, to my prayer. Listen to my plea for grace. And then he goes through, and in the day of trouble, I call upon you, you answer me. And he goes back to, he wants God to hear him, and then he tells God about calling upon him. And then in verse 8, he describes God, verses 8 through 10, there is none like you. And this is a good reminder, because what is David doing? David said, I got these problems, I want you to hear me. You can imagine a child coming up to you. Parents are busy lots of times. And I was just thinking about, we have a dog. And a dog will do the same thing. He will. My children are older, so they don't nudge me all the time. But the dog, if I ignore him, when he rings this little bell to go outside, he will come, and first he'll go, woo, 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 woo. And then if I ignore that and say, Charlie, I got to finish what I'm doing, then he'll come, and then he'll start nuzzling me, you know? And then if I ignore that, then he'll come, and then he'll start pawing me. He will not go away until I take him outside. You get the same sort of feeling here with David, where he says, hear me. How many times has he got to say, hear me? Hear me, hear me, hear me. And then he says, because I know you are good and you have steadfast love for me. That he will not be forgotten. He will not be overlooked. God will not turn his back upon him. But because of, just as sure as the covenant David has with him, is the steadfast love that God demonstrates to him. And so we find that same thing as we find as he reminds who God is, or he states who God is. And sometimes I think if I were doing this, it'd be just reminding myself as I am in this dire situation, and who can answer me. And he goes through 8 through 10. There is none like you among the gods, O Lord. Nor are there any works like yours. All the nations you have made shall come and worship before you, O Lord, and shall glorify your name. For you are great and do wondrous things. You alone are God. And that is such an awesome thing to remember, because the world around us, our own selves, and all of our circumstances always beat us down and try to make us forget the supremacy of God in every situation. And so David here, 8 through 10, states the power and nature of God. And then in 11, we have another request where he says, teach me your way. He wants to unite his heart with God. And verse 13, he repeats this same refrain, for he says, for great is your steadfast love toward me. You have delivered my soul from the depths of Sheol. the place of the dead. Now, David's life, he could say this quite honestly, how God had spared him through all of these different circumstances. And verse 14 is what he finally gets to, looks like the big problem that he's facing in verse 14. And in verse 14, he talks about these insolent men, and he says of these people, if you look back on all that he said about who God is and that he wants God to hear him and who he is, he said, I'm a holy person, you know, etc. He says, he reminds God that these people do not set you before them. These are insolent men, ruthless band of people who are going to seek to destroy him. And 15, he returns to, but you, O Lord, are God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. Then he closes out in 16, 17, where he talks about, turn to me and be gracious, give your strength, save the son of your maidservant, show me a sign of your favor, that these people will know that you are God. And so you see this same situation. I don't know about you, but lots of times I'll read the Psalms and I'll find myself in a situation and I will be drawn to something where, like David here, has a problem. We finally get to it, I believe, in 14. But he does all the 1 through 13s is setting it up with, hear me, hear me, hear me. I know who you are, and I know that you're loving. Hear me. And I've got this situation in 14, and I'm reminded of your steadfast love. Now, one of the things, since we talked about the nature of what David is calling upon God to do, What is it about David's life that he has such a grasp of this concept, this attribute of God, that he writes about it in Psalm 86, he writes about it in Psalm 103, talks about how great it is, and what is it about David's life? Well, think about, even from the smallest of children could explain some of the things of David. If you remember, what did David do growing up? He grew up as a shepherd. And what were some of the things that David ran into when he was a shepherd? Dumb sheep, of course. But what else did he run into? If you've ever been around sheep, you can understand. The lion, the wolf, the bear. And he didn't just run into them. He had to do some hand-to-hand combat with them. Now, I've been hunting on different things. One of my son likes to hunt, so I get up at 4 o'clock or something in the morning and go out with him hunting. But I've always been well protected. I'm the one that had the gun. You know, the things I'm hunting were not going to attack me. But there may be situations, and you read some about people who are hunting in Africa where that's not the case, where some of these animals they have over there that might attack them and actually destroy them. And so David is here is a very different situation. He's out with a staff, a sling, something, and he's got to protect the sheep, and he's got the lion and the bear. Okay, so he moves from that, and what's the next event that kind of happens in David's life? You have where he goes and meets his brothers who are fighting the Philistines, and you got this big guy who comes out and defies the armies of the living God, is how David sees it. You know, he's got all this armor. This guy's 9 feet tall, you know. The head of his spear weighs many pounds. I mean, all sorts of stuff. And David goes out to him with his sling and slays this giant. So what happens in the next chapter of David's life? He becomes famous. And what does the king do? The king tries to kill him. So David has to flee. And he lives in these caves and lives out in the desert. And a group of guys starts following him. Some of the times, if you read the story, he's in the very cave where Saul comes in. He has an opportunity to kill Saul, and he says, nope, it's not my situation to kill him. He's the Lord's anointed. And so he has to flee for his life over and over, and Saul promises what? Not to kill him. And he has to keep running. And so David, knowing that he's the king, could not take action to kill the king, to become the king, but he has to flee for his life. So then what happens next in his life? Yeah, the situation where I mentioned where they were off raiding, and some people come and they steal all of their stuff and take all of their families. And what did the people want to do to David? They want to mutiny against him and probably kill him. But they return and they are able to conquer those folks. And then next, his best friend dies in battle. Jonathan dies at the hand of the Philistines. And then what happens next with David? He becomes king finally, but he becomes king of the southern kingdom. And what does he have to go through? He has to go through a civil war and unite the kingdoms and become one kingdom. And then after that, you read about David's conquest of the Philistines and all the kings of the land. What would be a characteristic that you would describe these events in David's life? David, as it talks about, I was talking about in 2 Samuel, why he couldn't build the temple. David was a warrior, a fighter. He had faced death in all of these different situations his whole life. Now, I don't know about you, but when I read those stories, I sort of gloss right by them because it's sort of like reading, you know, history book in class. I just read right through those things. But one of the things that helps to kind of understand that was if you enjoy and read some of the military history, there's a book out that I read recently, and it talks about some of these same very situations in this guy's life. He was a Navy SEAL in Afghanistan. And they were inserted in this area to try to take out this chief or whatever of a band of Taliban fellows. And so they landed in this area, and they ran across a shepherd person, and they had a choice. If they let the guy go, then their cover is going to be blown, and they're in enemy territory. No easy way to get out. If they kill him, it's probably not the right thing to do, and they'll probably be prosecuted for doing that. And so they let him go. And with just a short period of time, they are surrounded on this hillside by hundreds of fighters, and there's only five or six of them. And the story progresses as they fight from the top of this mountain, always retreating down further and further. And they tell the story of one by one, the men get killed. And the guy who's the captain, they couldn't get signal to try to get some kind of air cover. He has to go out in the open, hold up the phone that he had to try to get some kind of signal, and he's killed doing it. And so the guy that the story's about is with the last man who's mortally wounded, sitting around a log as their last defense. And an RPG comes, blows him off the side of the mountain. He lands down below where they can't see him. He spends the day or the rest of the day there. He finally gets together enough. He's got a broken disc. He's got an injured leg, and he escapes. And now he's being pursued. The pursuers catch up with him. He kills them. He has no water. He has to find water. He is found by some villagers. The villagers have a decision to make. We take him in, and then we have to protect him. We let him go, and the fighters come and kill him. They take him into their village. He spends maybe weeks in his village. They have a rule of hospitality. You've probably heard about that some from the Middle East. If they take you in, they have to protect you. And so they protect him against the fighters who come and break in sometimes and break his bones and try to get information out of him. And so he's protected by these, and he lives in this fear constantly of sudden death, of being captured by those people, till finally an army unit, a ranger unit, I believe it is in the area, and they find out where he is and finally rescue him. Through those that events of that person's life, you have a sense of fear that's constant. You have a sense of loss of the people who's died. You have aloneness. You have grief, uncertainty, injury, hunger, and thirst. And sometimes in seeing it in that person is some of the same sort of things that you could see in the life of David as he went from battle to battle and life-threatening situation to life-threatening situation. And so when he says, and being delivered in all those places and all those situations, when he says here, Lord, for your steadfast love endures, he calls upon a God who has delivered him from Sheol. David has a life of circumstances that he understands his concept of God's love and protection for him. Now, I know it is a very difficult thing sitting in a Sunday school for us to make this great leap in ourselves as to what are the things that we face that we would put on the list? What are the things that we deal with in our own lives like David is dealing with here? He's got a group of insolent men who want to kill him. We are not, if we walk out that door, probably looking at a group of people who are going to kill us. But what are the things in our own lives, if I were to create a chart and say, here's a list of categories. I read you some at the beginning, like with David on the finance, that he had to live on the run. He was homeless for a period of time, and he had to take odd jobs. He didn't always get paid for his work. He lost his job as a magician because of a little problem with his boss. Okay, his family, his brothers despised him. One of the things about that, his wife was actually given to another guy, and she remarried while he was out on the run. His health, he probably suffered hunger and thirst and all the privations that go with being in the desert. So what are the types of things that we would put on the list? Think about it. I won't ask you to speak out, but what are the kinds of things that we would put on the list here that would be in the us column? Because we all have these situations, and we all have these uncertainties. We all have these things that make us feel alone or defeated. And one of the ones that would be on here, we say, well, what about the giant? I don't know about you, but there's a whole category that I would have down here at the bottom that would be called deliverance from past giants. Now, some of you who are very young haven't lived long enough to have a lot of giants in your past, of things you have to deal with that are problems, that are mistakes that you made, that are things that come back to you all the time, that your mind or Satan or whatever brings these things back to you and tries to defeat you over and over again. Sometimes you can never get over the sense of being sorry for something you've done. You know, maybe the guilt of something, or maybe it's maybe the weakness that you understand in yourself that you don't tell other people that you have. And that deliverance from these giants of your past and these things that pursue you. So if we were to fill out the list here, we could have a list that would be for us, and we could do the same thing with the psalm that David has done, and that he could say and that he could call upon and remember the steadfast love of God. It's not based upon what we do, but based upon what God has determined to love us, those who he's redeemed. Now, just a couple of questions in the minute that we have left. So, does anybody have any comments, questions? It's too bad Ed is not here. I always look for Ed. He's always got a good question or a comment. But are you going to fill in for him? Does anybody have any questions or comments about that? Okay. While you're thinking, what would be the things that keep us from doing this in our own lives? What are the things that keep us from, when we have these situations, turning back and say, remembering who God is and remembering what his love is to us? Does anybody have an answer to that?
Ourselves.
In what capacity?
We can fix it. We're too busy figuring out.
Right. If I did a survey, that would probably be, I was thinking the same thing, that would be my top one, self-reliance. That we are all taught to be self-reliant. That's a part of our culture. I don't know how much is still left in our culture, but we're taught to be, you know, figure it out and fix it yourself. I can handle that problem. You know, exactly right. Anybody else? Yeah, that's everybody else's problem. This is because of all these other people who never got it right. Okay? That's another good one.
I think if we skip the first 13 verses, we're in trouble.
Yes.
Because if you just start with, "Oh God, arrogant men have risen up against me," then there's right. not much hope in that. I
mean, yes.
The preamble is significant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought as I read down through there, I said, we finally get in verse 14 to what the issue is, but he set the stage for it, and he's hear me, because I know who you are, and then he finally gets what the problem is. He set it all up exactly right, because I usually start, I got this big problem, you know, I just rush in with this big problem, and forget the nature of God, forget all the things, and trying to go to him. I would say another one is time and schedule. Being too busy, that we don't have time to contemplate God, we don't have time to think about him, we don't have time to come and ask him, we don't have time to realize who he is, because we just have all of these other activities going on. And so it robs us of that understanding. I get too busy. Anybody else have another one? That would be a prevention. Forgetful, yes. Excellent one. Because when Dave mentioned in recently, I think it was about, it doesn't, Paul. I think Paul and Peter both say, it doesn't bother me to remind you of these things. We have to be constantly reminded of these. And we are so forgetful. God could do something just wonderful and we just thank him for it and then we're off to the next thing. You can see that in children. The children will get something and you know, they want something else the next day or the next week, and they just forget what you've done, and you go on to the next thing. And we're like that with God, that we are very forgetful, not only of what he has done, but we're forgetful of his promises. And I would say the last one maybe is that we have a very low view of God. A lot of the teaching, a lot of the situation is kind of diminished God, the man upstairs, the person, you know, he's my buddy, all these sorts of things. David doesn't do that in 8 through 10. He said, God, you're the one that created everything. This little group of men, all the nations are going to come to you. That we have a low view of who God is and what he's capable of doing. And if we understand who he is, then understand who we are, the thing that bridges that gap is the steadfast love that God has for us. And in that basis, we have this covenant of redemption, this promise of adoption. And it's not some, you know, abstract concept. It's bound up in his love for his creature. You can see that in the starting in Genesis chapter 1. God creates this beautiful garden and he puts his creature in it. And what does God do? He doesn't send him a message in the sky. He comes and fellowships with him in the cool of the evening. And then that fellowship is broken, and you have the whole story of redemption. Where does God go back to in Revelation? There's no need for the day, no need for a temple. God dwells among his people. And this fellowship that the creature has with the Creator. Okay. Let's pray together. Father, we thank you for your wondrous love and mercy to us. Thank you for your word and pray that you would help us, Lord, in our weak and feeble state, just to contemplate who you are, be reminded of your greatness, Lord, and trust in you. In Christ's name, amen.